Hi, I'm Kathy Forsey, Music Director at KC Cafe Radio. We're very happy to have New York native Ryder Street Freeman as a KC Cafe Radio artist. We're proud to be playing his songs from his album, The Waiting Sky, on the station. Ryder found early success at 18 with the band The Walk, but moved on to other interests outside of music after leaving the band. Years later, Ryder found new inspiration and passion for music with the birth of his child. His music is a blend of folk, blues, R&B, rock, and country, with lyrics that are introspective, intimate, and compassionate. Ryder, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me today on KC.
I'm really happy to be here.
Your website is www.ryderstreetfreeman.com. That's FREDMAN.com. And you're also on Amazon, iTunes, and CD Baby, correct?
Correct. Yep.
And they can also friend you on Facebook if they want to do that.
Friend me on Facebook, and there's a Facebook page, Facebook.com/RogerStreetFreeman, and Twitter is at RSF Music.
Great. Okay. I wanted to ask you about Waiting Sky. Is this your first solo album?
This is my first solo album, yes. It was. It's been in the making for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. So, so your daughter was kind of the catalyst for the making of the album?
Well, there were definitely one of the catalysts. I think in 2004, when my dad passed away, that was sort of the beginning of the depth of emotion that I felt at that loss was one, what should we say, one of the first sort of shots over the bow that to my soul that I needed to get back to doing music. When we found out that we were pregnant, that my wife was pregnant with Allison, I wrote a song that sort of came out whole, and that's The Miracle Is You. Mm-hmm. And went to we had a babysitter whose husband had a little digital studio in his attic. And she said, you should go record that. It's a beautiful song. You should go record that in the studio. And I went and we did a demo of it. And as I was in the studio with him, I had a real epiphany. I had forgotten how much I loved the whole act of recording and writing, and basically right then and there made the decision that I needed to move my life back to music.
Mm-hmm. What were you doing before you went back to music?
Well, early on, after I left the band, The Walk, I opened a recording studio. So with a buddy of mine, we were doing demo recordings, and I did that for a number of years. So came at the music business from that angle. And then after that, I went in search of more steady income and went into the design field, designing things that went into retail stores to show merchandise.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for a number of years.
Okay. And I know you talked about your father there. He was an artist as well.
He was. He was a graphic artist and also an art teacher, and then... He was a fine art major, and he went to City College in New York in the, I guess, in the 30s. And then after graduating, he got a teaching degree, and he was doing lithographs and also teaching. And then World War II happened, and during the war, he got married, and then he got wounded in Germany, came home. They had a son who's my oldest brother, and he went into commercial art, and he did that until he was about 70, at which time he retired and started painting again, and just created this fabulous body of beautiful paintings,
mm-hmm.
which I'm lucky enough to have hanging in my house.
Yeah, that's great. So was his artisticness, what did that influence you to want to go into design and all that sort of thing? Did you feel like that's where you should be instead of music?
No, I don't think it was so much that. I really just wanted to, I just was really in search of steady income. I was, you know, in my mid-20s at the time and needed to pay for an apartment and I guess get my life started. And I guess whatever avenues I had gone down in the music world were not providing an income at the time, so or enough of an income to do that. So it was really, I think I was lured in reality by the, you know, wanting to move out of my room, not have roommates, have my own apartment, have nice things. And, you know, it was kind of the siren song of
something to call your own.
Yeah. And I know we have, you know, we have some time, so I'll tell you that one of the catalysts was that I was, I had to move back home, and my father, who was, you know, perfectly healthy at the time, but he had a minor surgery that put him in the hospital, and I guess I was about 25 or 26, and I remember going to visit him in the hospital. You know, no matter what you have done in the hospital, nobody looks very good.
Right.
And I had this, like, thought that I needed to relieve him of having to take care of, having to have me live with him.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the, that was one catalyst.
So you've always been very compassionate then.
I think that is part of my character, and it's, yeah, we had, before I was born, sort of a tragedy in the family where my parents lost a daughter who was 15.
Mm.
And I was born shortly thereafter. And so I came into this household where everybody was, you know, grieving in reality. And I think out of necessity, I wound up being the, you know, I was this little baby. You know how babies are. They're filled with joy. So I think they wind up, you know, you wind up, everybody was very happy to have me. And I think I took on the role of trying to make them feel better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unconsciously when I was younger, and then more consciously as I got older.
Yeah. I can relate to that.
Yeah.
Let's go back to your father for a second. You wrote a song on the CD called You're Not Alone, which it was about like the last evening of your father's life.
Yeah. Yeah. It actually, I wrote the first verse. He was in declining health for a number of years. He had Parkinson's disease, and he had had a fall and was in, you know, he went to the hospital, and then they send you to these rehab facilities to get strong enough to go back home. And I would go and visit him at the rehab facility. And one night I got there and he was sleeping, and when I left, he was still sleeping. I mean, he slept the whole time. And he was, you know, all alone in this room. And so the first verse was really written then. And I didn't know how to finish it. I couldn't go anywhere with it. The first verse and the chorus. And then fast forward a number of years, I guess 3 or 4 years later, and I was in the hospital room with my brother and mother on the last night of his life. And he was essentially in a coma, and then we left, and he passed away later that evening. And that was when I was able to finish, you know, a little while after that, I was able to finish the song. I found out what it was about, you know.
Yeah, sometimes it takes a while for songs to reveal what they're
trying to say.
Yeah, yeah. So do you find like writing about these life experiences a cathartic experience?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think when I feel like I'm really getting some, anything I do that I like, I feel like comes from a very deep place and also changes me. And very often I feel like something is teaching me, you know, I'm trying to teach myself a lesson, or some power is trying to teach me something, and I have to say it. I have to go through the process of writing about it to understand what it is that I'm trying to learn, or that, you know, the universe wants me to learn.
Right. Yeah. You're quoted as saying that you write for search. Your songwriting is for your search for meaning. So I like that.
Yeah, it very much is at the most basic level. I mean, I think certainly I write some songs that are more tongue in cheek and not, you know, Life is Hard was sort of, you know, more about having to go to work every day.
Yeah.
And feeling like life was passing by. So it was sort of tongue in cheek, but in the end it was very autobiographical and so maybe not so tongue in cheek. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of lighthearted, but has a deeper meaning to it.
Exactly.
Another song that I really like on the CD is Time to Fly. Can you tell me what that song's about?
Sure. Well, I was, it's also autobiographical. On one level, it was about my going back and finding my music. So I'm really talking to myself. I'm the subject of it. At the same time, I had a number of friends. My brother, both of my brothers were getting to make big changes in their lives and were very, very scared, you know, nervous about it. Another one of my friends as well. And I just kind of wrote it for the four of us, you know, like it's, and again, that took a long time. That song took a long time to come about. I had practically 3/4 of a notebook of lyrics trying to figure out, you know, what the message really was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the whole idea of, you know, everybody gets so stuck. We get stuck. We think that we're in one situation and we have to stay there forever just because we're there. And it's just not true. It's all a mental construct. But we, you know, I certainly, and we all fall victim to those mental constructs. I mean,
right.
And years pass, you know.
Yeah. And before you know it, your life is just about over, you know.
Well, did you hear? I was reading an article about Bruce Springsteen and Rolling Stone, and the interviewer asked him, you know, why he's been so prolific lately. And he said, well, I see the train coming. and the interviewer said, you see a train? And he said, how old are you? And they said, 32. He said, well, you don't see it yet, but it's coming.
Exactly. Yeah. Now you get to a certain age and you're like, my life is over, half over now. What have I done? You know, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the other message in Time to Fly is it doesn't matter when, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it doesn't matter if you're, you know, 30 or 70, just take the bull by the horns and figure out what it is you need to do and do it.
Right. Yeah. And The Waiting Sky is kind of on a similar kind of theme as well, the title track.
Yeah, it is. It's I saw that kind of as a parable about the different phases of life. You know, you start out young and the sky's the limit and you can, you know, pretty much write your own story, or at least you feel that way and you feel like you got all this time. And then, you know, in the next scene, you're married and you have kids and you have a mortgage and you're a little bit, and you're so busy that the minutes just seem to fly away. And then in the last scene of that song, the person is in the house all by themselves, looking at a picture of their partner who we, you know, I think is deceased.
Mm-hmm.
And saying all that's left is just the waiting sky.
Yeah. So is your mom still alive?
No, my mom passed away as well 2 years later, 2 years after my dad. So, and she was there's a song on the album called Broken Hearted, which is about her as well.
Yeah.
My brother jokes that I write great funeral songs.
So did you sing at your parents' funerals?
I sang the song Broken Hearted at my mother's funeral. Yeah. I hadn't actually finished,
You're not alone.
Yeah. So, I had a really interesting evening. The night my dad died, I was sitting alone in my backyard. It was about 3 a.m. after finding out, after getting back, actually went back to the hospital and then came back. And I was sitting in my backyard. We had a little garden in Brooklyn and I was, drinking scotch, which I do from time to time. And I had this feeling like he was all around me. And it was palpable. And it hit me that I always knew that he loved me. And we had a really wonderful relationship, especially later on, you know, after I got through my adolescent years. And I'd always known how much he loved me, but it hit me at a deeper level that night. It was like I saw for the first time what it meant for a parent to love a child. I just remembered all the little tiny things that he would do and the way his eyes would light up when I walked into the room and all these things that you take for granted. And it just struck me that even though he was gone, that love would stay with me forever.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something, you know, very comforting in that thought. And I think I've tried to write about that in a couple of the songs that I've written.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I lost both of my parents. My mom passed away. It's been almost 12 years ago now, and I actually wrote a whole CD about the loss of her and her illness, and It was very cathartic for me. And, you know, you were talking about when the night your father passed away, and I knew the moment my mom was gone. I was like 100 miles away, but I knew the moment she was gone. I just felt it. So, yeah, there's something very special about a parent's love and losing that too, you know.
Absolutely. And I think it's and, you know, a couple of things. One is you really don't know what you've got until it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, and as a parent, and I'm sure you know this too, you know, I look at my kids and I'm like, you're never going to know how much I love you
until exactly.
until you have a child of your own, you know, or maybe when I pass away.
Yeah.
And it's okay, you know, it's fine. That's just the way it is. But
yeah, there's no other love like a parent's love, I think. And that's, and my mom used to tell me that all the time, you know.
I remember after my grandmother died, you know, who I loved my grandmother. My dad would say, you know, he would think, he said, I think about her every day, and I just couldn't understand it. I was like, mm-hmm. I don't get that. You know, I mean, I was 15 or 16, but I think about them practically every day.
Yeah.
You know, they're always with me.
Yeah, they, for sure. They're always with you. I mean, there's something, just like something somebody says or even something you say, you're like, oh my God, that was my mom. My mom used to say that, you know.
Well, they're in us, you know, the good and the bad, you know.
So. Exactly. Yep.
But the love remains, you know.
For sure. Yep. Well, let's get a little bit more lighthearted here.
Don't get me started.
I was going to ask you about the cover of the CD. Can you tell me where that picture was taken? It's a really cool picture of a, I don't even know what the car is.
That's a 64 Falcon.
Cool.
It's taken actually in the town that we moved to. I was telling you earlier, the town called Seacliff on Long Island. And we just saw that. We just loved that car and that house. And there was something about you know, there's the first verse of The Waiting Sky, which is about the kids in a car, you know, just putting the pedal down. So it felt very nostalgic to have that be the car. You know, that car looked like perfect for it. And then the house is kind of signifying the house from the last verse. You know, the old house that he's walking around in, or she's walking around in. And we kind of grayed out the sky so that it looked like everything was sort of melting into that.
Yeah. Yeah, the picture looks like it could have been taken in the 1960s.
Yeah, it's awesome. This woman named Megan Dewar did it. She's from Amherst, Mass. I just thought she nailed it, really hit it out of the park.
Yeah, it's a great photo. We were talking about your music. You were out of the music scene for a while, or as far as songwriting. What other kind of things were you working on back then?
Back in, before my...
Yeah, before you started writing again and pursuing music again. Were you doing music with other bands, or...?
Well, I didn't really do other things. After the studio closed, I had I always had a home studio and had good intentions of continuing to write and record, but, you know, that kind of fell by the wayside. It went dormant. I never stopped playing the guitar, and I would pick up the guitar and write from time to time, but without any kind of real goal it didn't seem, finishing songs didn't seem to happen that easily.
Mm-hmm.
I had one stint in the 90s where I put a band together and played a couple of shows in the city at the bitter end. And basically that was I had been married prior and then divorced. And that was the catalyst for that. So that there was a lot of breakup songs.
Uh-huh.
That was more just for fun, not really thinking about getting back into music seriously.
Uh-huh.
And then that was pretty much it, except for I have a very musical family, so we all play together whenever we're together. But in terms of going out and performing, that really didn't start again until probably 2010 or 2009.
Mm-hmm. So the songs that you were writing back in the 90s, were they like the introspective style that you have now, or is that something that's developed in the last...
Well, interestingly enough, there are a couple of, like I said, The Waiting Sky was in the works for a long time. At least three of the songs were written for those shows back in the 90s. So like Gone, Gone, Gone which is a breakup song about that was written back then, and Your Voice was written back then, which is pretty introspective. Yeah, I mean, I think I think I've always tried to get to the heart of the matter.
Mm-hmm. Like Don Henley.
Right. I wish.
Yeah.
Yeah, I often quote him, his lyrics. It's just amazing.
Yeah. I watched that Eagles biography. Did you see that?
Yeah, that was just unbelievable.
Yeah. I have a lot more respect for him than I do Glenn Frey.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. I mean, I love that just because, you know, it also shows the way people made records back in the day, you know, like really making it all about the song and then going in and just doing it the old fashioned way, you know, great playing, great singing, no auto tune.
Exactly. Yeah. looking for the right voice instead of getting the voice to fit the song.
Exactly. And doing it all analog.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I really am old fashioned. I miss like opening up a record and listening to it, you know.
Yeah, I miss the whole thing about vinyl. I mean, just the smell of it and the feel of it. And yeah, it was a lot more personal experience with music than it is now.
Yeah, and I think we've really gone away, especially with this digital thing and earbuds. You know, people have just lost the full experience. They're not getting all the sound that's recording with an MP3. You know, it's just
right. And the other thing I liked about it too was that, like, just the album liner notes and things. I mean, I could sit there and study liner notes forever, you know, and I would like read, oh, that guy played on that album, he also played on this album, you know. And I really got into that kind of stuff. And
no, I feel like we're missing, like, that's a really important part of the experience of listening to music is listening to, you know, reading the lyrics as they're being sung. And you know,
well, you got nice packaging on your CD. You've got your full lyrics in there. And so if people purchase your CD, they'll be able to read the lyrics right along with you, and really nice.
Yeah, I really wanted to make something that was would be a good package for people to dig into.
Right.
And I was lucky enough to have some really amazing players on the CD as well. So.
Now, your producer is Felix McTeague.
Yep.
How did you find him, and how did you guys start working together?
I met him through a mutual friend, and he checked out the, I had some, at the time, demos that I'd recorded, and he, I think Your Voice was one of them, and he really liked the, you know, the messages in the songs and the personal nature of the lyrics, and felt that that was something he really would like to bring out. And I knew that I needed somebody. I had no idea how to go about making a record, so I really wanted somebody that could take it from beginning to end and complete it, help me complete it. And he was just the perfect person. And we're actually collaborating again. I'm about to start in the next couple of months here, start recording the next album.
Great.
Yeah. And I mean, he's terrific. And he's, coincidentally, he's the son of Maggie Roach of the Roaches.
Oh, wow. He comes from good lineage.
He's got lineage, and he's also a great songwriter, and he's got top line credit right now on the a couple of tunes from the Florida Georgia Line, I think they are, the uh-huh. big country band.
Uh-huh.
So he's doing quite well, which is nice.
Yeah, and I noticed there's like several Freemans as musicians on here. Are those family members?
All family members. My oldest brother plays the harmonica on a couple of tracks. He's terrific, and he plays with he makes guest appearances with my band from time to time. And that's Dave Friedman. And my next brother is Lev Friedman, and he's a singer-songwriter as well. And he did some singing on it, but he lives in Boston, so it wasn't quite as easy to get him down. And then his daughters, my nieces, are Ari and Mia, and they have they're phenomenal players. They're Mia plays fiddle and sings, and Ari plays cello and sings, and they have an act called Ari and Mia, and they came down for 2 days and worked on the record with me, and their vocals are all over the place, and their strings as well.
Yeah, it sounds great. It's good to have that kind of family input on a CD.
Exactly. And we do, Ari and me and I have done shows together, which have been really successful. So it's really nice. It's, my band is terrific, and I love playing with them, and we've really grown to love each other. And then playing with my nieces, there's a lot of love in the room, you know? It's great.
Yeah, it's wonderful. So did you and your brothers ever play in a band together or form a band? Or
No, we never did. They're both much older than I. Uh-huh. And actually, they wouldn't let me play with them until I was about 10 because they said I wasn't good enough. And I used to get really mad.
You showed them.
I guess that was part of the inspiration to really practice. Uh-huh. So while we play music together all the time, we've never put anything serious together, although I did talk to them recently about the idea of doing something, so which would be,
you guys should at least get together and record a song together. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
That would be really cool.
Exactly.
So how long did it take to record this CD?
Well, I think it would have taken about a year, but we had a baby right in the middle of it. We had our second child. Uh-huh. And that set us back about 6 months. So I think it was about 16 months of actual recording, tracking, and overdubbing and mixing.
And you recorded at several different studios in New York?
Yeah, all in Brooklyn, in Dumbo, which is a really great neighborhood right under the Manhattan Bridge. And there are a number of studios there. And Felix had a little project studio where we did some overdubs, but we did the main tracking sessions at a place called Saltlands, which is a really beautiful studio down in the basement of a big building. And then we did overdubs at my home studio.
Oh, cool.
And it was really, it was just fun. The whole thing was great. One of the things Felix likes to say about recording is, you could have the greatest musicians in the world, but if it's not a good hang, it isn't worth it.
Right. Yeah.
And everybody was really genuinely into it. I mean, we had Larry Campbell, who toured with Dylan and played with the Levon Helm Band and now the Midnight Ramble Band and Hot Tuna. And, he's just absolutely incredible. And I was really intimidated, actually, that he was going to be in the studio. And he came in and he was like, man, these songs are great. It's like, I'm so glad you're doing this. Totally cool. And so from my nieces to Larry to Byron Isaacs, who played bass on a number of the tunes, it was just incredible.
Yeah. So do you plan on using a lot of the same people in the next CD?
I think we will use them. In the interim, my live band has really gelled. So and I've got just incredible players in that band. So I think for the tracking, it'll mostly be my live band. Hoping to get Larry in to do some overdubs and some fiddle and stuff. And certainly Ari and Mia are going to be on it. And Grace McLean, who did a lot of the backup singing as well, is down for it. So yeah, I think some of the same musicians, my band, and then maybe some special guests we're trying to line up.
That'd be cool.
Yeah.
So is the style going to be pretty much the same sort of feel as the Waiting Sky? Or
I think stylistically it will be definitely in the roots rock genre. I think I would say yes. So we've got a couple of more bluesy tunes, and also I'm trying to stretch out a little bit and do some more, kind of just go into different changes, not always this the 1-4-5 two minor stuff. So
yeah. Make it more interesting for yourself.
Exactly.
So who was the major influence on you when you were developing your style?
I really love the classic songwriters. My brother was a big James Taylor fan. I would say, I think when I was 10, I got a record player for my birthday, and my brothers bought me a couple of albums. The one was Jackson Browne's Late for the Sky, which I think I played until it
was worn out.
Until it was completely worn out.
Yeah.
And it's still one of my favorite albums of all time. Van Morrison, Moondance is a classic that I love. Paul Simon, for sure. I just...
he's still going strong.
he's amazing. I mean, I just think about, that song, My Little Town. He says, and after it rains, there's a rainbow, and all of the colors are black. It's not that the colors aren't there. It's just imagination they lack.
Yeah. He's so good.
He's so good. And Joni Mitchell.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been reading a book called Fire and Rain, and it's about 1970. And I guess in the author's opinion, this is like the time when music sort of changed. And he talks about the writing of Bridge Over Troubled Water. Mm. And it is really, I guess after Paul Simon wrote that song, he like called his manager and said, I just wrote the next Yesterday.
That's funny.
So yeah,
he did.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he's just amazing. And, you know, and of course, I liked a lot of progressive rock when I was, you know, in my early teens, preteens, and everyone from Genesis, Yes, and King Crimson to, of course, Led Zeppelin was a huge influence. But, you know, I don't feel like that shows up so much in my music, although I love that music.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of interesting.
Does it influence you as a guitarist, you think, or?
I think it's in there somewhere.
Yeah.
But I think... You know, I just wound up gravitating toward roots rock, folk rock kind of vibe for the stuff that I write.
Yeah, because lyrically it's a little bit more deeper than some of the stuff you get from the jam band kind of feel, you know.
Yeah, I think that's probably it. I mean, I really try to tell stories and put words together in a way that is emotional.
Right. So you wrote your first song about 10 years old?
Yes. It was not very good.
Do you know what the song was about?
It was about a girl that I liked.
Uh-huh. At 10, you had girlfriends?
I had a girlfriend.
Oh, boy.
I won't mention any names.
To protect the innocent.
Exactly. Yeah, it was like a simple love song. It was almost as bad as Roses Are Red, Violets Are Blue.
Uh-huh.
I think, but...
Did it have three chords?
It was this progression. I remember it. Right? All on a D chord.
Oh wow, that almost sounds Beatlesque.
Right. I think they were the only chords I knew. Then when I was 15 and 16, you know, I was in bands. And when I was 16, I started writing more serious songs, none of which were really that good. And I was actually in a band in high school that was pretty good. And we some of those people went on to real music business greatness.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the guys was John Karen, who's been playing with Pink Floyd for like the last 30 years.
Oh, wow.
So he and I wrote some songs together, but we never did anything. He went right from high school into the music world and did really, really well.
Yeah.
The rhythm guitar player was named Mike Latanzi, and he wound up producing a bunch of dance music in the late 80s, early 90s and did very well. And now has a studio down in Nashville.
Oh, great. So was this The Walk that you're talking about, or is it a different...
Oh, no, that was way before The Walk. The Walk happened when I was about 19.
Uh-huh.
And they were being produced by a guy who had worked with Foreigner, and I was basically just playing bass and singing, and we were trying to be a big hair band.
Yeah.
It was really good music, but just didn't get the attention of the record companies.
So was it that experience that made you want to get out of music for a while?
That kind of threw me for a loop emotionally, because I was just so young and all the guys were much older than me. And I don't want to say abusive, but it was kind of, I wasn't used to being kind of the low man. I was literally the lowest and the youngest guy on the totem pole. And it was kind of cutthroat, it seemed like to me. And it was not a good experience in the end.
And were you with a major label or?
No, we were really just shopping labels, we did a number of demos, two inch ready, you know, record ready demos, and I thought they sounded great, but it never got the attention of any label.
Were you a writer in the band too, or just a singer?
Nope. I was a hired gun.
which would not be a good thing, I would guess. That would.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great experience musically. I mean, in terms of like learning how to, like, I learned a lot about recording. Everything I know about recording, I basically learned when I was 19 in terms of how to play in a studio. And you know, that was a great education. And Michael Wright was the producer, and he was just an incredible engineer and producer. So that was a great experience. But in terms of the emotional and the interpersonal aspect of it, it was not a very healthy experience for me.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you put that behind you and you moved forward with what you're doing now, because the new CD is incredible. And we're so glad we're playing it on KC Cafe Radio. It's called The Waiting Sky by Roger Street Freeman. And we're playing about 6 tracks from that CD on KC Cafe Radio. So I hope everybody goes and requests those songs and listens for them on the station in a regular rotation as well. There's always a question I like to ask every songwriter. And it's a tough question, and usually it throws most people for a loop. But
all right, I'm sitting down.
I'll see if you can answer it. What's your favorite song by somebody else, and why?
Well, I'm just going to say the first one that comes to mind, because there are so many. You know, it's like it's hard to pick.
Right.
I could give you my top 10. but the first one that comes to mind is A Case of You by Joni Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just because of the imagery in that lyric and the emotion in that chorus. You know, the verse where she says, on the back of a cartoon coaster beneath the blue TV screen light, I drew a map of Canada with your face sketched on it twice.
Mm.
She says so much so eloquently with so few words. And then you're in my blood like holy wine. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that.
Yeah, lyrically, yeah. Well, there's so many ways she can't be beat, you know. I mean, even as a guitar player, she's just amazing as well, so.
I think she might be the best ever.
Yeah, pretty darn close.
Yeah, I mean, in my humble opinion.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate the time, and it's been so much fun talking to you.
Well, same here. I want to let everybody know again that they can find you at riderstreetfreeman.com. That's FRIEDMAN.com. You can also find you on Facebook. And what was your Twitter handle again?
At RSF Music.
Great. And if they want to buy your music, they can get it at CD Baby, Amazon, and iTunes. Do you have a buy site on your website as well? Or?
Yeah, there is a buy site on my website.
So you'd probably rather people go there.
Yeah, I think it's the Amazon site that
okay.
You click through to. We're working on our own store, but that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. Usually if you can do it that way, it brings you more money that way.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today and sharing your music with KC Cafe Radio and our listeners.
Thank you, Kathy.
And we're going to be looking forward to the new CD coming out. And you're thinking that'll be out when?
Probably the beginning of next year.
Great. In the meantime, we'll keep listening to The Waiting Sky and wish you a lot of success.
Thank you so much. Love the station.